just now as I was sitting here and people were coming into the hall and settling themselves and sitting up on the chair, I have a better view. And I just found I had a happy mind state coming, just seeing you all here. And I was feeling appreciation for you, for your practice, feeling grateful that I was able to spend time like this with people who are sincere and really interested in looking into their own mind and heart and understanding and living with more ease, more wisdom, more kindness. I just felt blessed to be able to be here and happy to see you all. And sometimes, you know, when we're in the middle of a retreat on your side, it's not easy a lot of the time. And we can fall into kind of, you know, we'll assess our day or a meditation period and might not look so good. So I have a confession to make. I've never been a very good yogi. I meet a lot of people in this role, when I'm in a role as a teacher, I meet a lot of people. And I met a lot of people who have more natural ability than I do. I think almost everyone has. But I have kept at it. I'm a role model for perseverance. Or in America we say doggedness, staying with it. But it's also a good idea to not trust your own assessment of your practice, because we don't know. And I have seen, despite, I'm going to start a bad yogis club, because I've seen, you know, it seems like I've seen a huge transformation over the years in my life you know, there's this path is moving towards freedom and happiness, and I have seen the truth of that for myself. And it's a work in progress here. I make no claims that the job is done, but I have seen a radical transformation in my life that is profound, and it seems to have happened in spite of me. So, just some reassurance there. If you keep at it, good things will come. Of that, I have no doubt. In that, my confidence is very, very strong. So if you feel your confidence wavering or feeling weak, I give you all that I have, and I have a lot. I have a giant amount of it, and I give it all to you. Anytime you might need it, you can have it, if it might be helpful to you. Marie and I, in our teachings, we make a lot of references to this person who we know these days as the Buddha. This person who lived and had a life and had a certain realization, it appears, and taught that. And we may not think of the Buddha very often. Maybe we never do at all. And we don't have, sometimes a lot of the places I teach, there would be some kind of statue here, an image, and maybe you've seen those. And they take on all kinds of forms. It's interesting, in India, when the Buddha, after the Buddha lived and died, there were no images for hundreds of years. The Buddha was represented either as an empty seat or as a pair of footprints. And when the Greeks came, they came across and came into northwestern India, and they said, "You don't have any statues of your god," because that's how they looked at things. And the very earliest Buddha statues look kind of like the Greek images of Apollo, with nice curly hair and kind of a more European features. That was when those statues showed up. But we see them now, and they're very generic, you know. They don't look like they're of a a particular person. They look like sort of very stylized. And this idea of this being, you know, and then we see them in temples, or there's gigantic ones, you know, these different countries have almost like a contest to see who can make the biggest one. And, you know, they get huge, and they just, it gets all unreal, and it's like this sort of mythical thing, or is this supposed to be some sort of god, and people are bowing and prostrating and doing all this stuff, and our connection to an actual living being is tenuous at best, if we have any relation to that at all. And we can forget that there was this person who lived a life, lived in northern India near the border with Nepal, where he is said to have been born, and had this life and somehow expressed this understanding, these teachings, which are quite, if you read them, they're quite remarkable. There's a brilliance, a genius in the way, the clarity of the mind in this person. And it has endured, as I think Marie was saying the other day, it's this unbroken flow, this river through time of people who have taken on and followed these teachings, and then all the weirdness that's happened and that happens with religions, you know, that, you know, I see these prophets like this Buddha or some of the other great spiritual teachers through the ages, you know, and they're all pointing at something that they want us to see. Like, there's this image, it's from, I don't know where, you know, fingers pointing at the moon. And they want us to look there, but actually the moon they're pointing at is in here. They're all pointing in here, into our own mind. But if it's a beautiful finger, we do this. We start looking at that, and then we build a temple around the finger. And we lose sight of, it was always pointing, but some of them stood back there and they pointed that way. And some stood over there and they pointed that way. So it looks like they're pointing at something. They're not, you know, we lose sight of the fact they're all pointing at the same thing. But because of the language and the time and the personal nature of their experience, it seems to be something different. So the Buddha was a finger pointing at something universal that we all, and this possibility, you know, he said, if it weren't possible for you to understand this, I wouldn't ask you to even try. But since it is, I offer this possibility. I went to India. I've traveled a lot in India, and I went there for the first time. Not the first time, but the first time I went on kind of a pilgrimage to these places that are important to the Buddhist tradition in India. And I went there, it's getting close to 25 years ago when I first went. And at that time I had read a book about the life of the Buddha, and it was kind of it was done in a very kind of a lush and storytelling way, so it had a lot of beautiful images, and it was fun to read, and I had a lot of these stories about his life in my mind, and I was going to visit some of these places, and so I started off in this place that was called Rajagaha at the time of the Buddha. These days it's called Rajgir, so it's, you know, still the same root of that word. And you can see the ancient walls of that city are still there. These walls that come down, they're crumbled, but they're there. And there are some places that one reads about where the Buddha spent time, caves and a park. And you can see, you know, they preserved these, and you can see these places that are mentioned. There's places where you can see ruts that are worn into the rock of old kind of chariot wheels or something that seem to have passed through an area. And so I had all this freshly in my mind, and I had it in, my plan was to travel overland from there to Bodh Gaya, which would have been probably a few days to do that. It's some distance, but it's, you know, not hundreds of miles. And I thought, oh, it'd be so romantic, arrive in Bodh Gaya, which is the main site of in India where the Buddha is said to have been enlightened, and a huge temple and very the most holy site in that tradition. And I thought, oh, I'll walk there. And I was told by various people that that would not be a good idea because this area is currently, or at that time, famous for its highway robbers, and I would be lucky to survive such a journey because I would probably be the victim of a robbery, and maybe more than just a robbery. So I let go of it. But it was so inspiring to me to visit these places that I had read about and actually see indications that they had actually were real, that they'd actually been there, these different things. There was a place called the Squirrel Sanctuary, and there's still a park there, and there are squirrels there. And you know, maybe the descendants of the Buddha's squirrel. And there's a famous hill, a small mountain, I guess maybe a mountain in Finland, a hill in other places. I've been told the mountains are small here. But it was called the Vulture Peak, the Gridakuda Peak. And there's a lot of stories about when the Buddha was there and gave certain discourses there, spent time meditating. And there's an old foundation of stone and brick that is said to have been a hut where he stayed in a cave there. And I used to, in a minute I'll tell a story about when I was going there, but it's said that the Buddha's, he had two kind of chief disciples. One was Mahamoggallana, and the other was Sariputta. And they were said to be his chief, his kind of right and left hand chief disciples. And it's said that the one named Sariputta was realized full enlightenment there up near the top of this hill, the Vulture Peak, in this cave there. And it's a beautiful story. It said that the Buddha was giving a discourse on mindfulness of feeling that Marie spoke about this morning, mindfulness of pleasant and unpleasant and neutral feeling tone that arises with everything that that contacts the mind and the body. And he was, and Sariputta was standing behind him, fanning him on a hot day. And he said in the story, Sariputta said he was listening to the discourse as though sharing food that had been prepared for someone else. So he was there, but it was, the Buddha was teaching this other person. And this is the quotation from the story of this in the suttas. Sariputta said, "It was to another one that the Blessed One, the Buddha, was teaching the Dhamma. And to the Dhamma I listened intently for my own good, and not in vain, for freed from all defilements I gained release at that moment." I have this beautiful image for me of this man who's caring for his teacher, fanning him while he's teaching someone else, but he's listening carefully to the Dhamma, and something gelled, something came in his understanding there. I was staying at this time at a place in the town that was, all of the different Buddhist countries have these, they're called viharas. They're like places for pilgrims to stay. And I had a very simple room at the Burmese place, vihara. And I had a lot of romantic notions then. I still do. But I would get up, I wanted to get up to that top of that peak for the sunrise. And so I would walk out in the dark, because it was took about 45 minutes to walk there. And it was scary. I was frightened, but I did it every day for a week or two. And every morning I would come and I would climb to the top. And there was that whole time, whenever I would get there, there was one monk who was already there sitting in meditation. And it seemed like maybe he just was always there, or he'd sat up all night or something. But it had this timeless feeling, and the sun rising there, and as though the Buddha was just there. It had this that feeling, gazing out over the fields, and rural India hasn't changed that much in these 2,500 years. So I'm never going to get anywhere near through this talk. But you won't care, and I won't care either. But I think I want to look a little bit at least some things about his life, because I think it can be useful both as a source of some inspiration to us, and also kind of as a it points to some useful, really important considerations in terms of how we approach this practice and our meditation practice. So it's a story of an actual person, and pointing to the fact that what he understood and realized is possible for us. And also we can see it as kind of a teaching story, or a mythical, allegorical story of what a spiritual journey, kind of more archetypal, if you know that word, kind of a portrait of a spiritual journey in a kind of broader sort of way. So it's said that the Buddha was born in this kingdom. He was born into a family of wealth, a small kingdom, a local kingdom. He was born as a prince. It's said his name was Siddhartha in Pali, Prince Siddhartha. And his mother died shortly after his birth, and he was raised by his mother's sister, Pajapati. And it's said that the king consulted a seer, a visionary, a sage, who said that his son would grow up to be either a great spiritual seeker and teacher, or would become a great leader, ruler and leader. And the king wanted the ruler, he wanted to follow in his footsteps. That's the version he wanted to have happen. So he raised him in very luxurious kinds of surroundings, and said that he wanted to prevent him from having any experiences that would send him off onto a spiritual quest. So he supposedly had all the best stuff, the finest food and clothing, and in his own words, the prince or the Buddha, in recollecting his life as a young man and as a child growing up, he said, "I was delicate, most delicate, supremely delicate, and had the best of everything." And he had three villas or palaces, places to live for each season there, for the hot season and the rainy season and the cool season. And he said that he had, there were gardens with pools with three different colors of lotus flowers always blooming, and he had only the finest sandalwood oil and incense, and the finest silk cloth from Benares, or Varanasi it's called, which was then and still produces some of the finest woven cloth in India. He was given the best education, all training as befitted someone who would inherit the kingdom, and was married probably at a very young age, an arranged marriage. He wouldn't have had any choice about that. And, but there was a point when he was growing up where he had this, what sometimes is called a call to awakening, a call to destiny in a mythical form, this sort of story form. He was called to leave that life. And it's said that the sort of fable stories that he had was visited by three heavenly messengers, or four heavenly messengers. But in his own words, he said he had these three reflections or thoughts came to him. And he had this, but in the story it said that he left the palace with his servant who drove this chariot. And it said that he went out one time and he saw an old person. And he apparently had been so sheltered that he'd never seen anyone who got old. And he said, what's wrong? What's wrong with that person? And the chariot driver said, that's an old person. Everybody gets old, even you. And he said, oh no, bad news, and went back to the palace to think this over. Went out another time and he saw a sick person, and he'd never seen sickness. And he said, what's going on with this? And then his driver said, that's a sick person. Sickness comes to all of us at some point. And oh no, even worse news. Goes back to the palace, bummed out. Not good. Goes out a third time, sees a corpse, a dead body. What's with this? That's a dead body. Everybody dies. All things that take birth come to death. This is nature. This is inevitable. Me too. You too. Oh no. Real bad news. Goes back to the palace. Comes out a fourth time and sees a wandering spiritual seeker, a sadhu, who looks at ease and happy, radiant. And he has this idea, oh, maybe there's some way to come to terms with these fundamental, you could say, existential dilemmas of what's life about if I'm just going to get old, sick, and then die? What's the point? So whether it's these, you know, heavenly messengers that were sent or these thoughts that occurred to him, this propelled him on this decision to leave this life, leave the life of ease, and to go on this quest. And he did. He left the whole thing, and he went off and said that, you know, he didn't see any way that he was going to be able to actually come to any real engagement with these questions and really figure something out if he stayed in that situation. It just wasn't going to happen there. And sometimes this kind of decision comes to us in our lives when we undertake with sincerity some kind of spiritual quest or walk a path like that. You know, to actually make this kind of external change. And I had my own version of this in a way when I first came to this practice. The first time I ever meditated at all was at a 10-day retreat. I went to a 10-day retreat without, I hadn't meditated for even a second. And it was kind of hard. Okay, another confession. I didn't do any of the stupid walking meditation. I thought it was stupid. People creeping around. I've since grown to love it, so this is not an excuse for you to skip your walking meditation. But I tried. I tried. And by the end of that 10 days, I felt this sense of possibility, and it was profound. And it came at this time in my life where I had just closed down a business that I'd been part of. I had a business with some friends, partners, and we had just closed that. We were good at the business. We were good at the work, but not good at the business. We were artists making sculptures and things for museums and movies and all kinds of stuff. Giant bugs and dinosaurs and things. And I didn't have a relationship that was in my life at that time, and there was nothing keeping me in my life, and I was ready for a change. And I came back from the retreat, and I was sharing I had this cool place I was living. This is getting worse and worse for me to get through this talk. I was living in this old fire station in San Francisco, right? Very cool city. And I lived in this old fire station that was from... it was old enough that when it first was built, they were using horses to pull the fire wagons. And it had this tower, and my housemate was a dancer, ballet and modern dancer, so we had kind of a dance studio, and I had a little art studio, and I had a cool motorcycle, and I had more hair, and I had I had taken my coolness level very high, which I know is hard for you to believe now, seeing me, but I was really cool. And there I was. But there was this thread of dissatisfaction also running through my life at that time. Not big suffering, but this sense of, I felt like I'd done everything I could to find a way to be happy and done everything I was supposed to and was as cool as I was ever going to get, and which was very important to me. And yet, it was like, well, is this all? And so I went to this retreat, and it was good timing, and I came back, and I said to my housemate, can I sublet my room, you know, rent it temporarily, and go, I wanted to go off and do some more meditation. Because I'd heard about this place where I teach now that you can do a 3-month retreat, and I wanted to go do that. And she said, no. She said, you're here or you're not. She said, if you're going to leave, then I'll get someone else, you know, but I don't want a temporary thing. So she kind of put me in a position of having to decide, and I said, okay, I have to go. So I let go of my life and where I was, my home. I got rid of almost all of my things. What few things I kept, I put in. A friend had a downstairs basement that I could store some things. And I just left my life. And I never went back to anything close to that. And I entered at that time into almost 23 years of not having a home and wandering, a wandering Dharma bum, as we say. And I had no idea that was going to happen. But I have a point here. You might not believe it. But there was this decision to leave the stability of my life. And I had a certain, there was some privilege to that in terms of that I had the confidence I would be okay. I had family and friends who I knew would be there for me if I needed something, and that I would always be able to find some kind of work and take care of myself. And that's a certain privilege that isn't there for everyone. But I was able to make that kind of leap. And sometimes that kind of thing might come to us. But more important than some external change that we would make, like me leaving my home at that time and my life, the stability of my life, and launching out into completely unknown, no idea what was coming next for that whole time, little bits of it. But there's this kind of this letting go, this renunciation, you could say, of something in that movement. And there's an internal kind of renunciation that is more more real and more important than external changes like that, a different kind of letting go. And it's said that the Buddha described his teaching and this practice as going against the stream. Have you heard that description? It runs against the stream. And the stream, you could say, is the river, or the flowing river of the current of desire and grasping, of the wanting mind. And you could say that when we flow with that stream, we're flowing with this current of desire, pursuing things and experiences in which we imagine we will find some kind of lasting happiness or fulfillment or contentment. And the reason that the Buddha said his teaching runs against this stream, and how this is this renunciation of this, of following that current, he said it goes against, it runs against that pull, not because it's evil or wrong, it's not a moral judgment, but because it leads to stress and struggle and discontent in the mind and heart. So we turn away from that energy of craving in this endless movement of the mind and heart to gratify our desires. Not because getting satisfying our desires is wrong or bad, but it just, it's limited. You know, and we use this word, certainly in America, renunciation is not looked upon. That is not the land of renunciation. Don't get me started on that one, but it's, you know, it's the land of excess and of getting and having stuff. More than anywhere else that I can think of that I've ever been. And, you know, we can think that this idea of renunciation, of letting go, means that we have to let go of ever having any pleasant experiences or any good times or fun, that our life will just become this bland, gray, sort of dull landscape with like some kind of repression. And we might think, well, okay, nuns and monks, they can do it, but it's not for me. And the Buddha didn't judge the happiness born of gaining one's desire, of getting what we want, of sense pleasures that we might chase after. He didn't say that was wrong or bad, satisfying our desires. What he did point to was that there's a limitation to that. That it's a limited kind of happiness. You know, in one teaching he talked about the kinds of happiness that one can enjoy through getting good, nice things and having good work and having good things and the things we can get in life. He said, yeah, it's great. But it only goes so far. And so in his teaching, what he is doing is offering us a chance to make a trade. Because we when we follow this desire, this current of desire, how long does anything last? You know, we satisfy one desire. How long are we okay? How long before we have to go after the next thing? Because it wears off. It doesn't last. It's not wrong or bad, but it doesn't have staying power. It doesn't have the ability to any one thing to satisfy us in the long run, you could say. Then we need the next thing, whatever it is. And the whole world of advertising is based on this idea of convincing us that we need whatever it is to be, then we'll be happy. And none of us would admit that we believe that, but then look, we have to look and see how we live our lives. So the Buddha says, I'll give you the chance to trade a lesser happiness for a greater one. And he spoke to this in this collection that Marie mentioned of the Dhammapada, these teachings in verses. And he said in there, if by giving up a lesser happiness, one could experience a greater happiness, a wise person would renounce the lesser to behold the greater. And a teacher, monk Tanissaro Bhikkhu, he goes by Tanjef, he's a monk in the Thai tradition. He has an image in one, he writes a lot. He said it's like trading candy for gold. So if we were offered to be able to trade a pound of candy for a pound of gold, we'd go for the gold, most of us. But most of the time we want both of them. We want the candy because we know it tastes good, and we don't trust that it's real gold because it seems kind of far out there. So this meaningful relationship to this idea of letting go of that, following that current, is actually, it's not from moving from happiness and fun to lack and loss. It's actually moving in a different direction. The teacher Bhikkhu Bodhi said this. He said this renunciation is to pass from gross, entangling pleasures to an exalted kind of happiness and peace. From a condition of servitude, in essence being a slave to that energy, to one of self-mastery, of being independent, to being free. Desire ultimately breeds fear and sorrow, but renunciation gives fearlessness and joy. I mean, that's powerful, that we could trade fear and sorrow for fearlessness and joy. That's a no-brainer, right? We say. It's obvious which one of those is better. So this letting go, this turning away from following that, is seen as the key to our deepest happiness, the key to peace. So he left his home, and he sought out these different teachers, and they taught a certain kind of meditation that had to do with really concentrating the mind to very, very deep kinds of absorptions, what's called jhana, where the mind gets very quiet and still and one-pointed, absorbed in just one object. It's a different kind of practice than we're doing here. And he said to have mastered this first with one teacher, up to seventh out of eight of these deep absorptions. And that teacher was so impressed with him that he said, "Oh, you can share. We'll lead the group together." And he said, "No, it doesn't go to liberation." He said, in his own words, he said, "I reflected, this teaching does not conduce to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to higher knowledge, to awakening. It only leads to this attainment of this state, this transient state." And then he went to another teacher who could teach him even more, even higher in that realm. And he mastered that, and he was so good. That teacher said, "Just take over. You can be in charge of the thing. You're better than me at this." And he said, "No, these are great practices, but they are not leading to liberation of mind and heart. They lead to conditioned, beautiful conditioned states that don't last." And so then he went on this 6-year period of practicing on his own in these extreme austerities, they're called, these practices that were very much denying the body, and very, very extreme, severe practices. They were widely practiced. They're still practiced in some parts of the world, in India today, by some people who are on certain kinds of paths. They still practice these severe things, trying to subdue the ego by being harsh to the body, and trying to subdue the mind. So he said, this is just one quotation, he said, "Supposed with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrain, and crush my mind with my mind. Just as a strong person might seize a weaker one by the head and shoulders and beat and constrain and crush him, so with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrained, and crushed my mind with my mind, and sweat ran from my armpits as I did this." Now, I don't know if any of us go to quite that extreme effort. Anyone here been crushing mind with mind, with teeth clenched and tongue cleaved to the roof of their mouth? But sometimes there's something for us to look at, because we can have this attitude that we're setting out into battle with our own mind and heart. We have this, can have this attitude that it's a problem. We see our own mind and heart as a problem. We see ourselves as something that needs to be fixed. We hold ourselves in this way that's very unkind and unskillful. So it's really worth looking. How am I approaching it? How do I hold my own mind and heart? Do I hold it with friendliness and care and kindness, which we've been stressing, or am I setting out to battle my own mind, my own body and heart? It's really worth looking. You know, and he tried all kinds of things. He tried not breathing. He said he tried just keeping himself from any air from going out his ears, his nose, his mouth. that violent winds carved up my belly, and there was a violent burning as if two strong men had seized a weaker by both arms and were roasting him over a pit of live coals. They tried these extreme things, standing for days, squatting for days, sleeping on a mattress of spikes, of nails, sleeping in a place where dead corpses were put to rot when people who were too poor to be burned and cremated. And he finally, he got to, he was using the bones of corpses as his pillow. So we're not going to be doing any of that this week. Just in case you're getting worried here. And finally, he started eating less and less and less, and he said he got to the point where he was eating one grain of rice a day. And there are these statues that you find in India and other places of this emaciated Buddha. He said he was so thin that he could push in on his front side and touch his backbone through his from the front. He was so thin. So, you know, we don't maybe go to that, these kinds of extremes, but it's worth looking at how we are practicing and how our effort, because finding a balanced way of practicing is, it's a constant, maybe not a project, it's a constant dance to try to find what is a balanced kind of effort for us, what is right or wise effort. And sometimes we have to go too far to find out what balanced effort is. And I'm not saying that we will, but there was a time when I was living in Burma and I was wearing the robes of alms mendicant, a monk, and I was practicing with a very demanding teacher, and I was putting out as much effort as I possibly could. And what I would notice sometimes is when I would get back to my room for the little bit of sleep I was letting myself have, it was when I would reach a point where I just gave up. I couldn't do anymore. I just had to give up. And that was the moment often when something, some insight arose, some understanding arose, was in that moment I couldn't try any harder. I had to give up. So sometimes we do have to push beyond what is skillful in order to learn what is skillful. But not necessarily. We don't always have to. But we need to look and see. Well, on one retreat, I put a sign on my door, on the inside of my door, that I would see every time I went out, and it said, "You can always be more mindful." Which is true for me. I will promise you that I can always be more mindful. Well, maybe sometimes I'm pretty mindful. But I told my teacher, and he said, "You know, I don't think that's such a good sign." Because it was based on this idea that I wasn't trying hard enough, that I thought it was skillful. And he said, "I don't think that's such a good sign for you." So I made a new sign that said, "Don't make problems." And I put that up, which was way better. It was much better for me. But I kept the other one in my drawer in case I discovered that I was just a slacker. But, you know, it's we need to look and see, because the Buddha compared right effort to tuning the strings of a guitar or a lute, a stringed instrument. If you get them too tight, they'll break. And you'll get a bad sound. If they're too loose, it'll boom, boom. You won't get a good sound. So not too tight, not too loose. So finding that balance of effort is really key. And it's always different at different times. But I think a lot of us often, for a lot of us, we make more effort than is actually skillful. I think that's our conditioning a lot, is to try, with all good intention, to try too hard in a certain way. So it's like I was talking about earlier today, the low heat steadily rather than turning it up, boiling it, and then turning it off for a while. That steady, gentle effort, that's what will carry us along, because then we can keep it up and we're not going to just exhaust ourselves. So I'm out of time. But after this whole time, the Buddha got to where he was almost had starved himself to death. And he thought, you know, there's no one who can take this austerity to a greater length than me. You know, whatever, I've done it pretty thoroughly here. And he said, and it's not doing the job. Maybe there's some other way. And he said that he remembered a time when he was sitting as a boy under the shade of a tree, and he was watching his father take part in a ceremony to, like a seasonal ceremony to begin the planting season, a plowing kind of ceremony. And he was just relaxing under the tree, and he spontaneously entered a kind of state of meditation that was very blissful and peaceful. And he remembered this time, and he thought, maybe that might be more useful. Something like that. Why should I be afraid of that? Maybe that is the way. Some way that has that level of ease and that I felt then. And so he was offered some food by a kind woman who was passing by. She was going to give an offering to a temple, a shrine at the base of a tree. And she saw him in this starved state and offered him this porridge of rice and milk, and he ate that. And he'd been practicing with these five other guys, and it sounds like from the story that they weren't doing much, but they were hoping he would, you know, they were egging him on, they were kind of hanging around saying, go, you know, as hoping he would realize something and they could get the benefit of it. And so as soon as he ate this milk rice, they got disgusted and left, saying that he had just reverted to luxury and become a slacker, and they just said, "Oh, he's a quitter," and they laughed. And so it was at that time that he regained his strength, and he had this sense, "Oh, there's a better way. This extreme effort isn't going to do it. This denial of my own mind and body." And it said that he went and sat under this tree in this place in Bodh Gaya, where Bodh Gaya is now. It was at just a tree near a river. And there's a descendant, it's said, a descendant of that same tree, that a seedling of it was taken away and raised in Sri Lanka, and offspring, and now there's one there, they say, that is the same, you know, the offspring of that original tree. Who knows? But it's beautiful to think of that. It's been planted there in Bodh Gaya. And he said that he sat under it and he said, "I'm going to sit here and I'm not going to get up until I realize whatever I can realize." And it said over the course of a night, he with a story that I don't have time to go into, there were some rough times. It said he was attacked by the armies of Mara, which we could say he had a really bad multiple hindrance attack. You know, all the kilesas and hindrances showed up at once. And he went through some difficult times, but it said that just as the morning star was rising in the sky before dawn, that he realized this enlightenment, this full, that all of these things fell away from him. And in a certain way, when we sit to practice, we come to the edge of what we think we can take in the same way. We sit under our own Bodhi tree. You know, we'll come to the edges of what we're comfortable with. And I remember the first time I decided I would sit without moving for 1 hour. And I thought I was going to die. It was so intense, but my resolve was very strong to do it. And then when the hour was done, I didn't have to keep sitting. I mean, I didn't have to move. I could stay. It was because I had gave myself permission to move. But after that, I thought, I can take anything. And it wasn't that big a deal in retrospect, but at the time it was just so intense to make that determination and to not move, to sit was very early in my practice. So anyway, I'm going to stop and let us have some time to walk and let these words drift away before we come back for some chanting. But thank you for your kind attention, and yeah, hopefully something useful there in terms of some of the attitudes we might look at, and this encouragement to really look at what is a balanced approach to our practice, what could be right effort for us at any given time. So let's just have a minute of quiet.